The format of this meeting is 2 10-minute speakers followed by our information break and then our main speaker who will speak for 30 minutes. Our first 10-minute speaker is Jake.
Hi, I'm Jake, an alcoholic. It's great to be here. Wow. So my sobriety date is March 4th, 2012. This is my home group. I have a sponsor. His name's Chris J. Just to get some math out of the way, I started drinking when I was 16. I stopped when I was 19. Coming up on 6 years sober in March. So, yeah, things are... That's for that. Okay, thanks, man. I got sober young, and that's like a big part of my story. It's a big part of my identity. To sum up my drinking very briefly, I had a really nice childhood. I grew up in a nice home. I did well in school. I played on the sports teams. I had friends. Had a nervous disposition, but other than that, things were fine. I had dreams, I had hopes, the world was mine for the taking. And by the time 3 years of drinking later, I was on the verge of being expelled from an Ivy League school. I didn't really care. I didn't intend on that happening. It just kind of happened. And that's where drinking led me. I'll share some of the fun stories, and they're funny here, you know. But thinking back on them, they were tragic. They were sad. Thinking back. So I had my first drink when I was 16. Very shortly after that, I fell in love with alcohol. It felt great. I never felt better. I was like a pretty uptight kid. I probably still am. And drinking just like, I finally was able to breathe, I could relax. I loved the way it made me feel. I chased that for a long time. Very shortly after I started drinking, the Yankees won the World Series. I was a senior in high school. I figured it was appropriate to cut school and go to the parade. And a few friends, we got on the train from Long Island at 9 in the morning. We started drinking vodka. I had intended on having a nice day, celebrating, a fun occasion. I had intended on getting to the parade, and it didn't happen. I got there. I was there. I was waiting to be let to the street. We were barricaded off. And anyway, I had to go to the bathroom. There was a bathroom in a bar. I somehow had a few more drinks. I ended up at another bar. I had more drinks, and I woke up some hours later in the hospital with my dad standing over me, covered in vomit and paint and all sorts of, you know, drugs in my system. I didn't do drugs at the time, but it was just like I was out of control, and that's like that's what happens when I put a drink into my body. Is I can't stop. Sometimes I can. Sometimes I get home safely. Other times, that's what happened. Things spin out of control. So that's just like, and that was very early on. The signs were there. It's a funny story, and I'll laugh about it, and I'll tell it again and laugh about it. You know, we're proud to fellowship, but I can tell you that it wasn't funny for my dad, who had to pick me up in the hospital and drive me home, thankfully I've since got to make amends for that, but like. There were consequences, and other people were affected by my drinking. Shortly after that, you know, just consequences. You know, run-ins with the police, disappointing parents, disappointing family, ruining relationships. I went to, another funny story I was just thinking about. I went to school, I went away to school for a year before college, and I remember I was up to no good there. I was drinking very heavily. My drinking was taking on epic proportions. I was blacking. I wasn't so much of a blackout drinker. I was more of a pass out drinker. So I'd say one out of two times I would make it home, and the other one out of two times I would end up passed out somewhere. So anyway, I was at this school, and there was a big event one night, and I had heard, I'd heard that the big teachers weren't going to be there, and some auxiliary teachers would be, and I said, all right, this is a good night to go out, right? So my friends and I went out. I drank way too much. I ended up passed out right in front of the school in a pile of my own vomit on the pavement, just like flat on the ground, at exactly the moment that the entire school was emptying out of this assembly with all the teachers, all the kids, and they didn't kick me out for that, but they kicked me out shortly after. Anyway, so just to fast forward, it progressed. I love the effect of alcohol. I drank for the effect, and the consequences got worse. And like I said, eventually I was in school, and I was all up to all sorts of trouble, and I was kindly asked to leave. I was at the end of the rope with my parents, so we had decided next thing that happened, I was going to rehab, and that's what happened. So I was sent to rehab in Mississippi. It was definitely a culture shock. It took me some time to fit in down there and slow my talking a little bit, and it definitely was an adjustment. But anyway, more importantly, I was down there, and I knew I had a problem, but I could not and would not admit that I was an alcoholic. Maybe I had a drug problem, but I was 19 years old. I was not ready to get sober, and I was kicking and screaming. I didn't want to be there. I was far away from home. I was on like medical leave from school, pending investigation, so I really had nowhere to go, and it took time. After a little bit, I started listening to instructions. I started listening a little bit, going to a few meetings, getting a little bit involved. And my first, I spent a year down there. I had inpatient and outpatient continuing care. It was hard. It was hard to be clean and sober. Like my experience, my first year of sobriety was, I started to feel a little better physically, and then my mental state deteriorated very fast. I went crazy. I couldn't talk to anyone. I had no social skills. I felt like crap. I was miserable. And I remember feeling as though I couldn't live life sober because it was impossible. And I also couldn't drink because I knew where that led me. And it was tough. And I know I'm probably running out of time up here, so I came home, and I just remember I was on the plane home from Mississippi, and I just remember thinking, I'm coming home. Not much has changed other than I've been sober for a year. I felt a little better, but I hadn't worked the steps. I've worked a few steps because I was coerced. But I hadn't really gotten very involved, and I hadn't really changed. Anyway, I came home, and I remember thinking, I'm going to drink. I'm all my friends are here. I know where everyone was. It was just like, it was going to happen. And I remember I came home and I called a guy who I knew had been sober, who I'd met while I came home once. And I said, hey, I'm back in New York. I need to go to a meeting. I remember I got off the plane. I came home. I had a bowl of mac and cheese. This guy picked me up. I went to a meeting in Brooklyn. And on the way home, I asked him to be my sponsor. He said yes. We started doing the work immediately. And it took off from there. And I don't remember exactly when it was or at what point in the step work or what point in the process, but for the first time in a long time, I felt okay. I was sober, and I started to feel happy. I started to feel at ease. I started to feel content. And it was a direct result of working these steps. And I wish I had more time up here. I've had ups and downs in sobriety. I've been more involved. I've been less involved. I went away for summer. I came back. I got involved in this group. But I've just found that whenever I am not feeling right, whenever, The answer for me is usually more spiritual work, and that means showing up here, making more calls, getting a new sponsor, doing the steps again. And the more involved I am, and because of that, I get to have a great life. Real quick, I'd like to thank my beautiful wife who's here today to support me. Didn't want to forget her. And that's it. I'm out of time. Thank you.
Our second 10-minute speaker is Sarah.
Hi, I'm Sarah. I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date's July 24th, 2010. I have a sponsor, Courtney. I have a sponsee. I've been through the steps. This is my home group, thank God. And Nicole, thank you so much for asking me to speak. It's really an honor to do the service commitment tonight. If you're new, welcome. If you're sad to be here, welcome. I was really sad for a really long time. I kept coming to this meeting when I was in early sobriety and just being like, I'm not getting it. And that was like 2 years. So it gets better. It gets so much better, but you have to stay in order for it to work. That's what I found out. Thank you, Jake, also, also from Long Island, and also from a really nice family who's not alcoholic and who just got this guy, I was their only girl, last child, I was supposed to be easy, and I was for a long time, I grew up in a safe and wonderful house, I had a lot of friends that I'm still friends with today, I just didn't seem like a great candidate for this, and I feel like, When in early sobriety, I would come to this meeting and I would sit here and I would try and disqualify myself from the meeting. I'd be like, I didn't come from a weird house. I'm young. I was 23 when I got sober. I have a job. I used to call myself high bottom, which to me does not exist. I remember taking a meeting into Rikers at 1 year of sobriety, and I was like, are they even going to get what I'm talking about? And after I finished qualifying, one of the inmates and one of the women attending the meeting said, oh my God, you should be in here. And I was like, oh! And it was true, just because I didn't get arrested didn't mean I wasn't a criminal, because I was. What qualifies me to be here, and if you're new, this was really helpful for me to understand, when I drink, I have no concept of what's going to happen. And I'd love to tell you that I have examples of times I drank 2 beers. I do not. It is 10 or more every time. I used to think that my sweet spot for getting ready to go out was 8 to 10 beers, and that is alcohol poisoning. I don't know what I was thinking. But and also, the other thing that qualifies me to be here is the fact that, even when I put it down, I can't stay stopped. A job can't save me, a loving family can't save me, friends can't save me. I will go back to it every time without a program. And I would love to go out there and do this by myself, you know what I mean? But thank God I don't have to. And actually, being on the other side of sobriety, I'm really grateful to have you guys and to have a program. So I went to college. I'm a blackout drinker. I black out all the time, shout out Courtney. My best friend always described me as like a bus without a driver. Like, I would just keep going and it would be crazy and my behavior would be insane and I would steal and I would start fights and I would yell and I would whatever. And I thought it was so funny. I thought it was so funny for the first couple years. And I would humiliate myself. I mean, deeply, deeply humiliate yourself. And sometimes in only a way a woman can. You know what I mean? Humiliation. And I would get up, and I would be like, ha ha, it's fine, sad clown. And that's what it was, for the first couple of years. But then when I turned 21, it just took a turn, it turned on me. I couldn't get drunk the way I needed to get drunk, and that was a 2-year period of me really hitting a true bottom. And you don't need to be arrested to hit a spiritual bottom. I was standing on the train platform going to my very important job thinking should I jump in front of this train? That's where alcohol brought me. And I think an example of when I started to realize that I did not have power over alcohol was I was up for this really, I was still in school and I graduated right in 2009, so it was the financial crash and jobs were scarce and I was panicked about it. And I had this really kind of amazing opportunity. I was working part-time, but they were going to give me a contract at a very, what I thought was prestigious job. And it was really important to me. But the problem was, one of the days I had to work was Friday. And we can't work on Fridays, guys, because it's Thursday. And I had missed, and this job was really important to me. I cared deeply about it. And I had missed 3 Fridays in a row. And my boss was like, no. And so I was like, okay, all right, can't go out on Thursday anymore. Also, because alcoholic, like a normal person could go out for a drink and then come home on a Thursday night, punch me in the face with one drink. Like, what? I don't want one drink. You know what I mean? Like, it feels just as good. So I remember thinking, okay, so I put all these curlers in my hair, like an old lady, and I was like, I'm going to be fresh for tomorrow. I locked myself in my bedroom, and I was like, I'm going to be there tomorrow. And within an hour, I could hear everybody downstairs. I could hear the party going. I was at the bar in curlers, blacked out. You know, I can't help it. I can't help it. This is like what my body is and my brain tell me to do, despite myself, despite what I want, despite it harming me over and over again. I can't stop, you know? So scary. And then the last 6 months were horrible, as you guys know. The benders get longer, they get more intense. I'd go anywhere with anyone, I would take anything. It just would get so, so dark. And I was trying to grip on so tightly to the things that I thought made me look okay. My job, my family, everyone's kind of still talking to me. It's all good. And it really wasn't. And my last night of drinking, I meant to have 6 Coronas. I had a little shopping bag of 6 Coronas. And I came to at like 6 in the morning in a laundromat in my town with some rando. And went to my parents' house. I didn't have, like, of course, lost my shoes, my keys, my bag, everything's gone. So I go to my parents' house and I tried to break into their house, punching out windows, push an air conditioner down a story. I'm all cut up and bloody. I tried to hide my clothes in their garbage can. I'm screaming on their front lawn at 6 in the morning. This is what drinking does for me. You know what I mean? At this point. And I remember standing on the lawn with my parents and watching them like watch what I had done. It's such a sad moment, but it changed my life. Because my dad walked into the house and he Googled AA. And that was on a Sunday, and I walked into a meeting on Tuesday and I never had a drink again. Like, that's what happened. AA worked for me, and it's still working for me, even when I try and not let it, you know? I got a sponsor. I came to this meeting, I got a sponsor. I started working the steps, thank God. That's how I really started to get better. She introduced me to a relationship with God. And you know how, like, if you're new and you get here and you feel like people are saying God or steps, and you're like, you're mishearing me. Like, I have an alcohol problem. Like, that is what will get us better. You know what I mean? And that's what worked for me. And I can say also that AA not only gave me a happy life, but it's also made me the woman that, like, I always hoped I would be and never thought I would be able to, because I had so much self-hate, you know? That's part of why I drank. I was so uncomfortable. I hated myself. And just a few weeks ago, my oldest brother had his third baby, and like 10 days after the baby's born, my sister-in-law, like, it's this crazy, like, lethal infection, and he has to pack her and his 3 kids into the car and, like, rush her to the hospital, and I was his first call, number one, because he knew, and it was a Saturday night. I should be blacked out without my phone in a gutter, but AA instead told me to pick up the phone. I picked up the phone. He said, I need your help. I beat him to the hospital. I was standing there with Duane Reade bags filled with formula. He walked in. I called my sponsor in the cab. I was crying in the cab, and my cab driver's like, we're going to get you there. It's going to be okay. And I was just like, people are wonderful. And I got to the hospital. He handed his 3 kids over to me without hesitation. Those kids have never seen me drunk. When they see me, they're happy. They know they're going to be cared for and safe. And I'm sitting in this hospital. And listen, like, if I got to AA and I was like, your gift of sobriety will be like spending a night in the hospital with like 3 kids that aren't yours, they'd be like, no, thank you. But like, it's so meaningful to me to be able to be part of my family today and to show up for them and to be the first call. Like, how does that work? And AA has restored me to sanity in a very, what I think is a short period of time. It's only been 7.5 years, and I feel like, I just feel so lucky to have this, you know? Like, not everybody gets it. And, you know, like, I was reading yesterday, like, we have to be ready to receive the gift, right? Like, there's a million people in this room who freely want to give you the gift of sobriety, but unless we're ready to receive it, it's not going to work, you know? And how I, like, started to receive it, I think, was when I would pick up the phone when a girl was calling me, or some girl would offer me gum and I would say thank you and I'd start crying, you know, or like when people my hands would be shaking when we'd have to say the prayer and someone would give me a squeeze, you know, to let me know it was okay and that I was safe, and it's just so meaningful to me. It's the little kindnesses that helped me stay. And because I stayed, I got to get better. So if you're new and you're struggling, or you're a couple years in and you're struggling, that happened to me too. I lost my mind at 5. Like, this keeps working, but we have to recommit. That's my experience. And again, like, When I say AA worked, I mean you. Like, it's you who showed me how to do this. You still show me how to do it. I was just having a conversation right out on the street right before this, being like, I don't know what I'm doing anymore. And someone would just calmly talk to me, you know, and is telling me how to do it. And I don't know what my life would be without it, but I don't want to imagine that. AA made me the person I always wanted to be, and that's kind of the greatest thing ever, because I get to share it with my family and my friends and my colleagues, and I get to be proud of who I am. I'm not afraid to make eye contact with people anymore, you know? That was a hard one. But I'm so grateful to this group. I'm so grateful to our structure and the solution and the discipline that I got here. I wouldn't trade it. And if you're new, please stay. Thank you.
Our main speaker tonight is Zach D.
Hi, I'm Zach. I'm an alcoholic. Can you hear me? You guys were so great. Thank you. I'm a little mad at Sarah because I was going to tell a story about my sister's kids, and now I can't. But I probably still will because I love them. I got sober on December 1st, 2007. I have a sponsor. His name is Duncan. I am working on my 9th step. 10th, 11th, and 12th step. I still have some amends left to make. I sponsor other people. This is my home group. I have some service commitments here and a lot of friends, which is great. I'm not from Long Island, so you're welcome. I'm from Westchester, the Long Island of the North. And I grew up in a lovely town called Irvington-on-Hudson. We used to walk to school on the historic Croton Aqueduct. I had a hot older sister, and my older brother played football. So I was really in a good spot. Everybody liked me. Hey, Hannah. You made me hit the microphone. Anyway, all that is just to say that, like, I really did grow up in a lovely home, in a lovely area, surrounded by lovely people, and I for a while, I think I was a really lovely kid. I was really outgoing, I was a pretty smart guy, I was the kind of kid that would, like, send thank you notes to parents after sleepovers. You know, you'd sort of be like, I mean, is he trying a little too hard? But it's a nice thing, right? And that was sort of my reality, you know? And I don't know why I changed. I don't know if I even changed or I just became aware of it. But there was a period in my life when I was like an adolescent, early adolescence, maybe 11, 12, 13 years old, where all of a sudden all the things that I used to love and enjoy about the world, including all of you, became the things that I was afraid of the most. And that's really how I can define that period of my time. And my fears were so big and so unreasonable, and I just felt like they were coming at me from every which direction. You know, I told you I grew up in that, like, idyllic little town, and I would be in middle school where I would literally walk to school on this, like, dirt path with the trees, you know, and the little flowers. And I would see some kid that I'd known, you know, for the last 10 years of my life since preschool walking towards me on the aqueduct, and my first thought was, like, oh, he's here to, like, beat me up or harm me in some way. You know, I grew up in this town in Westchester, and I was like, gang violence is going to break out, and it's going to start with me. I really, like, I honestly thought that, and I was, you know, I was, as I said, I was a smart kid. I had this math class that I used to take first period when I was in eighth grade, and in New York State, we had these things called, like, the Regents. That was, like, the exam that you took at the end. And my experience of that class that year was I would sit in that class for 3 to 5 minutes every morning, and then my hand would shoot up, and the fear would be in my throat, and I'd ask to be excused, and I'd go downstairs, and I would dial the calling card that I had memorized and my mom's phone number, and I would call her, and I'd say, Mom, I'm not going to be able to do it. I'm going to fail this class. I'm a terrible student. Nobody likes me, all that stuff, every morning, almost every morning, but, like, a lot of mornings. You know, I got an 100 on the New York State Regents that year. You know, my reality and what existed in here was just so far apart. And it was overwhelming, and it was terrible, and I hated it, and I started to pull away from all the relationships I had. I started to want to do nothing but sit at home. Even the people that were my best friends, I was just constantly thinking about all the ways they didn't like me. I went to this summer camp up on Lake George, and I remember, like, one summer, like, walking across the field, all these kids I'd grown up with, and they were all, a few of them were like sitting in a circle. And I remember thinking to myself, I should go and socialize. That's what you're supposed to do. And I would like walk over. And the whole time I was walking over, I was thinking, why am I doing this? You're such an idiot. These people don't want you to sit down there, right? And then I would sit down there and I would sort of be like talking, and then somebody would laugh and I'd be like, why are they laughing? Is it because of me? Did I do something wrong? Somebody got up to go to the bathroom, God forbid. They're leaving because they don't want to sit near me. You know, that was just like what was going on in here. And, you know, I didn't have to look very far. I didn't have to search very far to find something that fixed all of that, and it fixed all of that instantly. And for me, you know, I remember really specifically the first time that me and my friends at a sleepover decided that we were going to start sneaking up and down to his mom's liquor cabinet, just having little sips of that and little sips of that. And the feeling for me was immediate, and it worked really, really well, and it solved all those problems. It really did. All of a sudden, I was able to exist among you people. You know, the oppression was over, and I was thrilled about it. Like, I was really excited, and I wanted to tell anyone that would listen, like, that was the thing that we had to do. And I was like, well, if we're going to have a sleepover, like, is there a liquor cabinet? If we're going to do this, like, can we get this? You know, and I was really working hard at it. I didn't have a good stomach for alcohol, you know. Like, I could drink hard alcohol, but I couldn't drink beer. And so, you know, there are different parts of my story where a lot of other substances get involved. This was one of those early on. I was smoking a lot of pot. That was something I did. It was easy for me to get my hands on before I could get alcohol all the time. But it was doing the same thing for me, which was that, like, it was enabling me to participate in the world again. And I really don't have much of a drinking story besides that. That's like the reason that I did it. It's the reason I did it for the whole time that I was doing it. And I don't really, like, have all that much, like, to add to that for you. You know, I drank and did that stuff for 10 years. I was 25 years old. I was living in Manhattan. I got an apartment on 19th Street between 1st and 2nd Avenue. My plan with my roommate at the time was that we were going to get an apartment so we can smoke indoors. That was the whole discussion. We agreed. Because we were living in our parents' basements in Westchester, and, you know, you had to go outside. And there's winter, and there's rain, and it's just inconvenient. And so we had this, like, really brilliant moment, you know, and I was, like, you know, such a good manipulator at that point. I wrote this landlord, like, I was working as an actor at the time, and who wants to rent an apartment to somebody with no income? And I wrote this guy this, like, long letter about how, like, you know, everybody gets their break somewhere, and mine starts with you. And this guy called me back, and he was like, you know, that letter really touched me. And I was like, still got it, you know. And I get to this apartment, and I remember so vividly the first night in this apartment on 19th Street between 1st and 2nd Avenue. Brown painted wood floors, you know, holes in every wall, creatures running around, a little, you know, it was really gorgeous. But it was ours. We didn't have a piece of furniture. We had some clothes and bags. And I sat on that floor smoking indoors, drinking, and I thought to myself, yeah, we did it, man. I was so happy. You know, if only then I could really see what was coming for me. Once I got some independence and I started to get some jobs and started to make money on my own, this thing really accelerated for me, you know, and it accelerated at a rate that still alarms me when I think about it. It wasn't but a couple years later that, you know, I woke up after a really long weekend of, like, partying and hanging out, and on that weekend, the guy that I knew, my roommate's older brother, who was the worst drinker that I know, the most disgusting person that I'd ever met, but I loved to hang out with him because he always said yes, but he was like a real problem. He walked away from me after the second day, and I was like, well, that's weird. And then, you know, I went back out to the bar, and at this point, I was doing a bunch of other drugs as well, along with my drinking that I'd picked up along the way. And I came to the next morning. It was a Tuesday morning. I was in bed with somebody that I swore I would never go to bed with. You know, this was the person that when I first saw them at the bar, I was like, oh, that's what, like, that's a bar fly. And now I was like, well, there's my Romeo, you know. And I had things in my pockets that I swore I would never do. I had things in my pockets I had lectured my friends about doing, lectured them about how inappropriate that was and what that was going to do to them. And I was just to the gills with all of it. You know, my cell phone was dead. I walked out onto the corner of 14th Street and 8th Avenue, and I knew that I had an appointment that day. I knew where it was. I knew what time it was, but I couldn't figure out how to get anywhere. I was in the middle of the Manhattan grid, and I was completely lost. I could not figure out where to go. And I went over to the payphone on the corner, and I used that calling card that I still had locked in my memory from when I was in that math class in 8th grade, and I plugged those numbers in, and I called my Uncle Doug. And I didn't know anything about Alcoholics Anonymous before I came here. I really didn't. I don't know anything about it except for two things. One was that my Uncle Doug was the nicest, happiest, most fun 6'8" basketball playing uncle you could possibly have. Then all of a sudden he was like 110 pounds in a hospital in Paterson, New Jersey with a collapsed lung on the brink of death, burning down my aunt's house with a cigarette. And then he was Uncle Doug again. And the only thing that changed in the middle that I knew of was he went to Alcoholics Anonymous. My dad, my mom was really sick. I was 15 years old. He couldn't stop drinking. My mom kicked him out of the house while she was, like, you know, on her way out, had the strength to kick him out of the house. I was so mad. I thought it was all going to end, that my family was going to be torn apart. My dad came back and has been my dad ever since. And all I know that was a difference in his life was he went to Alcoholics Anonymous. So in that moment, I wasn't thinking, I'm going to AA, but I just want you to know what I thought of AA. I called my uncle and I gave him this laundry list of problems that I had, you know, and it was long, you know, money, relationships, laundry, and I'm not kidding, like, I was that, like, you know, my poor father, I used to call him towards the end and, like, try to get a pat on the back for having, like, taken out the garbage and mopped the floor. I'd be like, yeah, it's like, I had a good day, took out the garbage, and poor guy. But, like, you know, those were the things I was talking about, you know, like the things that people were doing wrong to me, that work maybe wasn't working out. And I gave him this, like, dun, 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 this. And he's like, okay. And I, mind you, I had picked up that phone and dialed him probably 30 times before that and hung up before or immediately after the first ring. But for some reason that day, on that payphone, shout out to the payphone users, I let the phone ring and he picked up. And he said, okay, it was like a Tuesday, he said, well, why don't you not drink until Friday? I'll pick you up, I'll take you to my house upstate. And I was just like, you are so dense. You know, like, I love you, but, like, did you not hear anything that I said? Nowhere in that list was, like, I can't stop drinking, nothing about alcohol, nothing at all, you know? I was afraid I was going to die from the combination of substances I was putting in my body, sure, and I was willing to talk to people about that, but I wasn't into a conversation about stopping any of it. I just wanted you to hear how afraid I was and just feel sorry for me and to see how terrible it had become. And this jerk has the audacity to say to me on a payphone, I'm like rock bottom here, and he's like, just try not to drink until Friday. I was like, come on, dude, I got you. That's so easy. So, you know, like a handful on Wednesday and like a little puff on Thursday, you know, I made it to Friday. And he's like, I'll pick you up. And he picks me up and he's like, did you drink? And I was like, no, man, I didn't drink. Like, what are you talking about? No, man, I didn't. Well, like last night, I went into my freezer and there was like a little wild turkey, so I just like guzzled that down. And he did that annoying AA, you're happy, I'm not, laugh. And if you're new like I was then and that laugh is really ticking you off, the reason they can laugh is because they know that there's a way out. So it can be funny now. And when you see the way out, it can be funny for you too. But it was not funny for me then. And he laughs and he's like, huh. I was like, what? He's like, I don't know a lot of people that don't like to drink or have a drinking problem that use the word guzzle. Again. And I was like, all right, great, whatever, man. And he took me up to his house upstate New York. And my aunt was there, and she was also a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And they were like, yeah, man, like, you know, like, go move the wood pile over there a little bit. And, like, can you clean up some of these dishes over here? And, like, you know, like, go run around the house, you know, that kind of stuff. Just, like, do some stuff, you know. And I'm, like, starting to get twitchy. I'm feeling really uncomfortable. I'm, like, nauseous a little. I'm sweating a lot. I'm, like, these people make me so anxious, you know. Like, God forbid I acknowledge the fact that, like, this is physically what happens to me when you take me away from alcohol for 12 hours. All of a sudden, my body starts to freak out. And I remember trying to go to sleep that night in that bed for the first time in as long as I can remember without putting something in my system to get to bed. And it was just hell. It was terrible. I was so uncomfortable. I didn't know what to do. And I just was, like, plotting. Hey, Matt. I was just plotting and trying to figure out, like, how I could get out of there as soon as possible so I could go address the real problem. And they took me the next morning. I don't even remember much if I slept, but we woke up and we had breakfast, and my aunt just AA cackled at me. And I was like, you know, what is it? What is so funny to you this morning, having gotten a full night's rest? And she was, like, pointing at my coffee cup, which was just, like, waves, you know, like white caps overflowing because I couldn't hold it steady. And she's like, yeah, no, you're doing great, man. You're really doing great. And I was like, it was starting to seep in, you know. Like, this guy had told me, why don't I try not to drink for a couple of days? Fail, you know. I'm not drinking. I'm physically sick, you know? I'm shaking. Like, I'm so chill. I don't know if you noticed, but I am, and I'm shaking. And they take me to this meeting, and I get there, and it's like this, like, weird group of people in this room above a church, and they're sitting around a table, and there's this guy who's like, no offense, 200 years old, with, like, glasses, you know, like, real glasses. And he's got this deep voice, and he's talking about all these things that I'm like, dude, I'm, like, so sorry that happened to you. But, like, you know, I hadn't been to war. He's talking about wars. And he was, like, at one point, he's, like, started talking about train travel, and I was just, like, eye roll, you know, like, whoa. You know, I'm better than you. And this situation you're talking about. And then he started to talk about this character that he created when he started drinking. And, like, my ego certainly perked up because I was like, what character? I'm an actor. The character is being talked about. Clearly they're going to want to hear from me. But I started to honestly think, like, oh, yeah. I like that guy can do all the other things that, like, I can't do without the alcohol, without the other stuff. And I was like, yeah. Okay, that, all right, take away 175 of the years, you know, a centimeter of the glasses, and actually that's a little bit me. And he started talking about how his life changed and how he's been able to get sober. And I just... I don't know. I left that meeting. They gave me a copy of the book Alcoholics Anonymous, right? And I still have that copy of that book. And those people, they came up to me. They talked to me. They wanted to, like, shake my hand and take my phone number. And they were all very insistent that when I got back to New York City that I go to a meeting and that I get a sponsor. And I was like, both of those things sounded like terrible ideas. But enough had transpired at this point where, like, I was, like, really freaked out about what was happening to me physically. I was like, maybe there is something wrong with me. If I sound a little bit like this guy, you know, maybe he is a little more like me than I want to admit that he is. And I just, like, had a little bit of clarity, and I realized that, like, there were times that I could think of when I was, like, 15 years old that, like, I remember thinking to myself, like, tonight is, like, not a good night to get loaded. You know, I've got X, Y, and Z tomorrow, whatever child, you know, a soccer game. Like, probably not, like, a good time to get loaded. And then I remember being on the bus to the soccer game, like, drinking vodka out of my gym bag. And I was like, yeah, man, like, this was actually, like, maybe even messing with you, like, more than you want to, right? So I'm just, like, a little willing. And I came back here, and, like, I went to a meeting at Perry Street. I went to a couple other meetings. I came to a meeting here. I ran into Rajesh. He's still got me in his phone. It's like, you know, it says something like crazy guy, December 7th or something. I don't know. And he was like, come to the holiday party. And I was like, no way. But, you know, I met this guy here who was like really wanted to be like close to me a lot. He was like wanted to keep talking to me, and he was like really tall and kind of intimidating. And he kept talking. He was like, I want to be your sponsor, you know. And I was like, okay, you know, whatever, man. Like, he's like, come out to dinner with us. I'm like, okay. I go out to dinner with him. He's like, he's telling these stories about how he stayed up for 3 days straight, and the other guy's talking about how he used to like chew glass at the bar. You know, and I'm like, and then one guy goes to like put his arm around me, and I like leapt out of my seat, and I was like, and he's like, dude, are you like okay? And I was like, these people are so insane, and they're so enthusiastic, and like I just get escape, you know. And he was like in the subway, and he's got his book out, and he's like reading to me about the new man walking hand in hand with his sponsor, and I'm just like, okay. You know, like, okay, man, sure, call you in the morning. And I called that man in the morning, and he became my sponsor. And, like, I cannot begin to describe how valuable, like, that relationship was to me. Because I don't know if I made it clear to you, but I had really no idea what was actually going on with me. Like, I was completely incapable of, like, honestly telling you what my problem was and seeing it for myself. I was sure that I wasn't an alcoholic, and I wasn't a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, but I didn't know what an alcoholic was, and I had no idea what Alcoholics Anonymous was. And I'm not going to explain that to you, because I fail at explaining that to people. There's only one place where I've ever found a definition of that that makes complete sense to me, and that's in the book Alcoholics Anonymous. And that guy sat down with me, and he read it with me. And he said to me, you know, why don't you write down some examples of, like, how you're, like, powerless over alcohol, you know? Because I was, like, the unmanageable part, obviously, you all get it. I was, like, right on board with that. But the powerless over alcohol, I was like, I just don't know, you know? And so I wrote down all this list of things, and I, like, told him these, you know, stories about how when I used to not be able to stomach beer, as I said, and so, you know, the every once in a while, somebody would come into town that had a good ID and could get into the liquor store, which was like a big deal in Westchester, like to get into the liquor store. And so when they would come, I would get all my quarters and like empty out like the, you know, like the coins of the world thing. And I'd be like, yeah, I got $20, you know, and like here. And they'd go and they'd get me the biggest bottle of vodka that they would get. And I tied a string around the neck of that bottle of vodka. And I tied that string around a rock. And I stuck it in the stream next to my house so I could have ice cold vodka every day after school or whenever I needed it. And this guy's looking at me like, what, you don't think that you have a problem with alcohol? And I told him this story about how I was at this, like, thing in New Hampshire. It was like a theater thing, and they were giving out, like, we were doing like a secret gifting thing, you know, and everybody got like a little souvenir from New Hampshire or something like sweet and lovely, and I got a UV suit, which is basically a plastic suit that you wear, and they gave it to me so that I didn't ruin my clothes when I threw up on them. And, like, I laughed and was like, that's okay. And then the next night, I'm, like, literally crawling through the bushes in the rain with, like, vomit dripping off my suit. And I'm, like, rip the thing off. And I'm like, this is great, you know. And he's like, yeah, man, like, no, people don't look for the silver lining in that, you know. I started to understand the truth about myself as a result of talking to somebody else and having them reflect it back onto me. And it was a really important experience for me, and I hope that everybody in this room like gets to at least give that a try once. and reading what the definition of alcoholism is in the book Alcoholics Anonymous related it into my life in a way that nobody in person had ever been able to do it. You know, there are words in there, there are descriptions of there of alcoholic behavior that account for what had happened to my life in a way that nobody had been able to account for it before. And, you know, there were a lot of things that I found objectionable when I first got in here. You know, I didn't like the idea that you were implying that I was insane. You know, I didn't like the idea that you thought that, you know, I needed to have some relationship with a higher power. I found that very intimidating. I found it really difficult to sort of rationalize how one like me could possibly do that. And at every step, basically, after realizing that I was an alcoholic and having people up here tell their stories and look me in the eye and tell me that, you know what, man, this doesn't get better for people like us. If you have this thing, thanks, man. It doesn't get better. My aunt told me on the first day that I tried to stop drinking, and she's sitting there making fun of me, she said, the elevator keeps going down. You can get off at any time that you want. And, like, I got scared. I got honest. And then I just got active, and I started participating in AA because I was like, you know what? Maybe, like, there's a way out of here. And I remember, you know, early on they told me, and then the sponsor that I have now likes to remind me about this idea of unity, service, and recovery in AA, you know. And Adam asked me to speak tonight, and the unity part of that is about this, like, fellowship, you know. And people started asking me to go to dinner, and I just went. Because the alternative for me was, like, to go sit at home in this chair that I can still remember to this day and count the seconds until I could pass out. Because I was fighting so hard. And I would go out to dinner, and we had this little crew, me and him and Marty and Scott. And Adam would say things like, you ever put your hand up, and you, I hear you went, I'm going to punch you right in the mouth. People don't do that here, right? But, like, he was my buddy, and he was looking out for me. Marty, I used to call that guy every day, and I would say to him, this is the day, man. It's been nice knowing you, but I just can't do this anymore. I'll see you later. And Marty would be like, I don't know, man. Like, can you call your sponsor? Like, I don't know, dude, can you meet me at the meeting tomorrow, you know? And I would meet him at the meeting tomorrow. And they told me to get a service commitment. I wanted nothing to do with that, and they made me a greeter. And I was like, this is, like, terrible. And then, you know, all of a sudden, next thing I know, I'm with this girl, Christine, that goes to this meeting, and all of a sudden, we've devised this competitive greeting plan where we would stand on opposite sides of that hallway, and we would just challenge each other to get people to turn left or right when they walk through the door. And I was busy, and I was going to meetings, and I was doing what you people told me to do. There was one guy who was really tall, smoked cigarettes. His name was Jim. I was so afraid to go anywhere. I would go to the corner of whatever meeting I was going to, and I would wait until I saw his big, tall self come out and smoke his cigarette. And then I would run over, hey, Jim, you know, and then I could go into the meeting. And the recovery part, I got into working the steps with the sponsors. They're outlined in the book. And it changed me. And the first thing that changed, and this is the thing that still shocks me to this day, was at some point in those first 90 days, I don't know exactly when it happened, but all of a sudden, like, there was another option over, like, getting loaded. All of a sudden, it wasn't just constant negotiation about whether I was going to do it or I wasn't. And that change has been the most awesome thing that's ever happened to me in my entire life. And I can't entirely describe to you, like, when it happened or at exactly what page of the book that it happened to me or whatever. But I know that the promises that I found in that book, everything that these people told me would happen to me if I came here in terms of my relationship with alcohol, all of that came true. You know, I didn't like the idea of a power greater than myself. It's changed and it's moved, and it's the incredible thing about it is that I don't have to explain it to you. You don't have to explain yours to me. I didn't have to, like, go to a special place and sit on a mountain until a tree grew out of my forehead in order to find it. I had to follow the directions that are in this book. And when I did that, thank you, I had a relationship with that power. And, like, the thing I identify the most when it talks about, in our 12th step, the idea of a spiritual awakening or a spiritual experience, is that it's changed my reaction to life. So now, you know, life happens to me, and it's amazing to me, but the first thought that enters my mind is not, how can I get loaded? If I went outside and the wind blew too hard, I was thinking, how can I go get a drink? I deserve it. You know, nowadays, things happen to me, and that it just doesn't enter my mind. And I believe, like, as a fact in my life, if I stay here and I continue to do this, and I sponsor other alcoholics, and I continue to make, you know, the meetings that I commit to going to, and I continue to stay connected here, that that won't return. If I continue to do that, I believe that is a fact of my life. And I know that because I've seen people that are sitting, frankly, a lot of them, thank you, in the same seat they were in when I got here. I've watched them do it, and I see the proof in it. Thanks for listening.